He had a limit in 5 cast. No lie.
Time for the Angler Within podcast with Roy Bilby.
Hey, JD, how was your Thanksgiving?
My Thanksgiving was snowed in.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Snowed in. I had a, I was supposed to go down to Matt's, actually, and...
You were supposed to fish, weren't you?
I was supposed to... We did fish. We fished on Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and we fished on the Friday after Thanksgiving.
That's exactly what I did. And it was cold. Plans to fish Thanksgiving Day and close out this 37,000 I was digging on. And I couldn't get there because we got 12 inches of snow. What a disappointment.
And now we're having some ice start to form.
Oh yeah. And the window on the open water has slammed shut. I knew I had to get it done. Real quick story. I was trying to break, most people know I've been counting the bass I catch and release since 1986. I was coming down on 37,000. I needed 57 more bass to break 37,000. And I went out the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, passed up on a good day of deer hunting. Good thing I already have one in the freezer that allowed me to do this with a clear conscience, because I'm a man torn two different ways in deer season. I want to get my deer in the freezer, and I want to be on the water because the bite is usually so good, and I can just add numbers so well. Well, I needed 57 on Wednesday, and I went out, and I had to work for them, and I know you always laugh when I say, oh, I struggled to get 31, but that's what I caught. I caught 31 that day. The bite was pretty good, and they were finally grouped up in the wintering hole, and I've been waiting all season for that to happen. With these water temperatures going up and down, they finally dropped enough where they settled into the wintering holes, and I had a good day. I plucked out 31 smallmouth and a couple decent walleye, so that brought me within 26. Now the forecast for the next day in our area, Thanksgiving Day, was for 2 to 4 inches of rain snow mix. And I said, I'll just put on an extra layer. I'm going out in that, and I'm going to get those 26 fish so that I can deer hunt after Thanksgiving and get back in the woods. And then I get home that night, writing in my journal, turn on the forecast, and they had changed it to 8 to 12 inches. Well, our elevation at our house is 1600 feet.
You're way up there. Yeah.
Oh, we got the 12 inches of heavy, wet snow. I plowed 3 times and shoveled 4 times. That's all I did the entire day. And I don't know how many people are aware of this. Everybody knows fish bite good when it starts to rain. Have you ever fished when it starts to snow? The bite is insane. I have done that a number of times, and it's unbelievable how good bass will bite, largemouth and smallmouth, when it starts to snow. So I knew Thanksgiving Day, the bite would be, I mean, it slam dunk, get my 26 remaining fish. I needed to break 37,000. I knew that it was going down, but with 12 inches of heavy, wet snow, I had to plow and shovel all day just to keep up with it. Now, the day after, Friday, as you know, in our region, temperatures plummeted. It barely got above freezing. And
it was low 30s. We actually went fly fishing that day.
Yeah,
we were standing. How'd you do? We were standing in the river, not as well as on Wednesday. I didn't catch anything, but Sean picked up Wednesday. He got a nice 20 inch rainbow that was out on the Susquehanna. Sweet. And Friday he caught a couple nice, you know, I don't know, 13 inch browns. Nothing crazy.
No, but, hey, Friday for me was even tougher. And the whole time I'm fishing, I'm knowing that they had to be chewing Thanksgiving Day with that snow. And here's the problem. Now that the water temperature dropped down, and it was 40 degrees on Friday. The following day, it was 39 degrees. It's getting into that. They're locked into the winter. They're going to be in that wintering hole now until April, and they just don't have a choice. That's where they're going to be. So you have a captive audience. But my captive audience had fed like crazy Thanksgiving Day, and I'm there the next day with a water temp at 40 degrees. Remember, these are cold-blooded creatures. Their body temperature is 40 degrees. They're metabolizing at 40 degrees. They only need to eat about once every 5 days, and they fed heavily the day before. So I'm fishing for fish that do not want to bite and do not need to feed. And I'm throwing nothing but artificials. I needed 26. I worked my butt off, and I got 16. I whittled it. I fished more time than I did the day before Thanksgiving, and I caught half the number of fish.
So question.
Simply because I knew they'd fed so heavy the previous day.
Question.
Yeah.
With this number, just so everyone, just to clarify for the listeners out there, your 37,000 bass, right? That includes obviously large and smallmouth.
That's right.
Right. Not just largemouth, but large and small.
It's a largemouth, smallmouth blend. It's that's a combined total since 1986.
Right.
Every season I fish. I just kept a running total.
I did find it interesting that on your Instagram in your comments, somebody had pointed out what I pointed out before when you and I... So just so you guys know out there, when we go to put up an episode after we've recorded, I always ask Roy for a fresh photo from his recent exploits out on the water. And you had sent me a few weeks ago, you sent me some smallmouth photos, and I was giving you a hard time because the smallmouth, the color on the fish was a little opaque. Opaque. Is that the word? Opaque? Opaque?
Yeah, they were. They were very pale because they'd been deep.
So it was funny because when I went back and forth, and then somebody got on your comments and was like, "Looks sick," and you're like, "It's not sick. That fish is fine.
Yeah,
it's just cold."
Yeah, that was because it had the blotches on it.
Yep.
And I said, "Well, no, it's not sick. It doesn't harm the fish." And they responded with, "No, I meant sick. I mean, that's cool."
Oh, you don't know that nomenclature, do you?
Yeah, I do.
Do you know sick is a good thing?
Yes.
Who uses that around? Is it from working on campus? You were working around kids. They all said it before to you.
Yep.
Yeah, makes sense.
But I took it the other way this time because it was a fish that was all blotched, you know?
Well, they're so pretty in the summertime. These smallmouth, especially when they get the tiger stripes and everything.
Cold water period deal that shows up.
Yep.
Doesn't harm the fish. It's a total lack of pigment in their skin. And so it's a black area. The scientific name for it is about 85 characters long, and I can't pronounce it. They just call it blotchy syndrome, blotchy bass syndrome.
Blotchy bass. So what are we talking about today?
Well, I just want to complete that. I needed, I caught 16 the day I needed 26. So that left me needing 10 bass to achieve my goal. And the picture we'll post for this episode will be that 37,000th bass since 1986. And I needed 10 the following day, but Saturday, good grief. I got up at 5 a.m. I want to get this done. I'm like, all right, this is the fourth day in a row I'm skipping deer hunting to get this accomplished. And I've got to get back in the woods. All I need is 10. I can surely, even if it's a tough bite, I can do that today. So I I got up at 5 a.m. because I was so anxious to get this done, and the air temp was 18 degrees. But an hour later at 6 a.m., it had dropped to 17, and by 6:45, it had dropped to 16 degrees. I can't fish open water in that. And it hung there for 2 hours, but then it started coming back up. When we hit the water, it was 31, and we went to a different pool. I abandoned the fish I'd been catching and went to another pool that was, it's a good wintering hole. And I hadn't fished it in like 4 weeks. And I hit it. My first two casts, I caught bass. I go, great. Now I'm down to 8. It's going to go down right now. and no more bites for an hour and a half. So I left that pool and shot up to the pool I'd had them figured out in. I didn't catch one on my first cast, but I caught one on my second cast. Now I need seven. And it's building and building. I got within two fish, and my bite shut off. And I struggled for like an hour with nothing. So I moved to a different area, and I caught two consecutive. The second one was number 37,000. And before it got too dark to fish anymore, I ended up getting a couple more. So I'm at 37,002, and I've got all my fishing goals accomplished for the year, and I am back in the woods. But next week it's supposed to hit 47 to 50 degrees by Wednesday, and if Otsego Lake is open, I just might be out there fishing for perch because I can't help myself. I hope I get a deer before that, but that's my story. And what I want to talk about today, I just want to throw out some fishing tips. Haven't done that in a while. I got 10 tips that will make you a better fisherman and make a difference in your results. And you can go right out and apply them. Again, these are mostly open water tips, but I want to put these out there. Before I do that, let me ask you a really weird question. You up for that?
Yeah.
What is your earliest childhood memory? What's the first thing you can remember as a child? How old and what is it?
I was probably 3.
Yeah, I can't remember that
and,
far back.
Go ahead. My dad dropped a bocce ball on my foot.
That would be memorable.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay. Well, my very first childhood memory involves fishing, believe it or not. The earliest thing I can remember, I was 5 years old. My family was going up to the Great Sacandaga Reservoir with another family for the weekend. And I'll never forget, that was my first experience with that lake, which is one of my favorite lakes of all time. It has become. Little did I know then I'd be, you know, competing on that reservoir and getting paid to catch fish there, winning tournaments and such. But at 5 years old, the very first thing I remember about that trip is the cars pulled off to the side of the road by this little mom and pop store. And the other guy, the other family, the father went in. He was my dad's business partner. They had a construction company. And he went in and he bought night crawlers, which was totally foreign to me. We used to dig worms out of our garden. And even as a 5-year-old child, I could not understand the reasoning why you would pay money to buy something you could get for free with a shovel. It made no sense to me at 5 years old. And I still think that way. If I can fix it myself instead of paying somebody, I do it. Self-sufficiency, right? But it just boggles my mind that at 5 years old, I couldn't figure out why he would pay money for worms when you can just dig them up in the garden. And I remember sleeping in bunk beds with my best friend at the time, same age, 5 years old, under bear skin covers, bear skin blankets. I remember that vividly. And the next morning we woke up, they took us across the road down to the water's edge, which seemed like forever, but it was probably just the other side of the road, armed with cane poles and those worms. And my dad had taught me, you put it out there and you let the fish find it. Well, this other 5-year-old, he's moving his all over the place. He's wiggling it, shaking it, and leaving it in one spot for like 8 seconds and then flipping it somewhere else. And it was driving me nuts. And I turned to him and I said, you have to let it hold still so they can find it. And he argued back, no, you got to move it so they can find it. I said, no, you have to leave it still. And it occurred to me just recently that at 5 years old, I started my career in offering fishing advice. Kind of makes me laugh. So here's my 60 years later, here's my current fishing advice. Here's 10 tips to help you become more efficient and a better angler on the water. I'm a tournament guy, and I compete against guys that we all have access to the same lures. So in order to attempt to outfish these people on any given day and beat them in a tournament, I tweak almost everything I throw to give myself an advantage over the other guys throwing the same lures. And here's some examples. Tip number one, if you throw a buzz bait, try this. Take the blade, lay it on a piece of wood, take a drill bit, and drill 3 or 4 holes in each side of that blade. What this will do, you think a buzz bait leaves a bubble trail on the water when you throw it? Try that and see what happens. I mean, it's like Lawrence Welk out there, tiny bubbles. I mean, you're making a bubble trail unbelievable, and I know it gives it a slightly different sound in the water. And on certain days, they want that, and it makes all the difference between getting a bite or getting ignored. You can also do that with spinnerbait blades, but the big deal is to do it with a buzzbait. Just try that sometime. It does not harm the buzzbait, does not change the way it runs. It just changes the way it sounds in the water and the bubble trail that it leaves. And there's days when it makes all the difference in the world. It's an easy modification to do, and nobody does it. Nobody's doing that, and they don't sell them that way. So that's a simple modification that you can do. It's easy to do, and it's that's tip number one. Tip number two, if you throw a tube, you know that there's certain days when the fall rate is critical. When they're hitting it on the drop, if it drops too fast, they're not going to bite it. There's certain days, like when the water's cold, you want a slow drop. The problem with that is if you use too light of a jig head to get that slow fall, you can't always feel what's going on as well as you can with a heavier weight. So what I do to compensate for that, if I want to slow down the fall, I use the same size jig head I'm comfortable throwing all the time. And day in and day out for me, that's a 1/4 ounce jig head, anywhere down to 20 feet deep if I'm throwing a plastic tube. But the way I slow it down is not, you can use heavier line, but sometimes that will impede the number of strikes you get. A much better way to slow the drop rate on a tube jig is if you order stuff, mail order through the mail, get stuff delivered, FedEx, anything like that. If you order delicate items, many times they're wrapped in sheets of styrofoam. I'm talking like 1/8 inch thick, almost like sheets of paper or cloth, but they're styrofoam. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
That stuff they wrap packages in. I save those sheets. You can cut those into small pieces and just keep a handful of them in your boat or tackle box or a storage compartment. You stuff those inside a tube. It does not change the profile. It does not change the appearance. What it does is it makes it more buoyant and it slows the fall rate, yet you still have the same weight. You can still cast as far. You can still feel everything it's doing, but it slows down the fall rate, and that's the only thing it affects. So it gives you a slower drop on those days when the water's colder and the fish are looking for that, and it'll get you more strikes. So carry some of those styrofoam sheets. Don't just throw them out. You can't recycle them anyway. They're not recyclable. I recycle them by cutting them up, putting them in my bowl, and use them to slow the fall rate on my tubes. And I don't think anybody else is doing that anymore. Another modification, tip number three. For soft plastic baits, if you've got really off-color water, and I'm talking dirty water, I've said this enough, people know I go to really, really dark baits. On days when that isn't enough, you can purchase from Bass Pro Shops or any of these outdoor outlets, all these places have them, little glass rattles. They're made for inserting into soft plastics. they do make a difference. I've got three or four different brands, different kinds. Mostly the glass ones are the loudest. They have little BB shot in them, and they're molded smooth on one end, but they come to a point on the other, so you can insert them into the plastics. The only plastics they're really difficult to insert in are like the Z-Man plastics and the Strike Kings that are made with the Elastec. Those baits that are super durable, you can stretch them out. You can stretch them out to arm's length, and they go right back to the original shape. They're very difficult to insert rattles in. But standard soft plastics that aren't made out of that, the ones that are just made, the Plastisol baits, which are the most common, you know, 95% of the baits out there that are plastic baits are made out of Plastisol. They are the ones that you can insert these rattles into. And they make a difference in off-color water. That's why they put rattles in crankbaits. They attract fish. Crayfish, they make a clicking sound. So I'll often put those rattles into soft plastic craws like the Berkley Power Craws and the Bass Pro Shops Crawdad plastic imitations. Anything like that, that the trailers that I use on my jigs, I'll just fish those on a regular football head jig by itself or on the back of a skirted jig, but I'll use those rattles when I've got really, really dirty off-color water. It helps attract the fish, and it helps home them in on that bait and helps them to find it. Tip number four. Now, this is really cool that people haven't been doing this for a while, but it was all the rage back about 25 years ago, and that is, who uses red treble hooks on their crankbaits? Anybody out there doing that, still doing that? I am.
Red treble hooks?
Red treble hooks.
Is that because it looks like it's bleeding?
Well, that was the original premise. Jimmy Houston, always one of his tips was always add a splash of red to any bait, and you'll get more strikes. And that's the basic thought behind it. When they came out with that, some lure companies were issuing baits with the red treble hooks. A lot of companies like Mustad and Eagle Claw and other companies that are well known for, you know, the hook manufacturers, they started producing red treble hooks. You can still get them. I bought them by the gross, by the 100 packs in size 4 and size 6 to swap out hooks on some of my crankbaits. Back when I was attending seminars, you know, 25, 30 years ago, I went to one in Albany, and one of the Bass University seminars, my son and I used to go to those together. I went to one by myself one year, and one of the presenters there was none other than KVD himself. And it was about a year after these red treble hooks came out. And when we all broke for lunch, I went to go out. You had to go out of the venue to get something to eat. And I was walking down the hallway, and he was there in the hallway talking to like two or three guys. And I went, oh, cool. I had lunch yesterday. I'm going to have lunch tomorrow. Today, I got the opportunity to hang with KVD for lunchtime. I'm doing that. Because he wasn't taking lunch. So I just kind of joined in the conversation or hanging out with him and these other three guys. And I said, I want to ask you a question. What's your thought process on the new red treble hooks that everybody's making? Do you think that makes a difference? He said, let me tell you something. And this is straight from Kevin Van Dam himself. He said, when they first came out with that, I was skeptical. Very skeptical. I thought it was a gimmick myself. He said, so I went out to prove it wrong. I went to this lake that I can catch a lot of fish on a crankbait. So he said, I removed just the rear treble hook from one of my Strike King KVD series crankbaits, and I put a red treble just on the rear. And he said, I'm going to catch 10 fish and see how they're hooked. And he said all 10 fish were hooked on that rear treble. Then he swapped it out, put the regular one back on, and put the red treble hook on the front hanger. And the next 10 fish were all hooked on the front treble. He said that settled it in my mind. It absolutely makes a difference. So he would run his crankbaits with a red treble hook on the front hook. That way they had to get the whole thing in their mouth to get that. And they would usually, the second hook, you know, the trailer hook would, the tail hook would grab him anyway, and he'd have both hooks in the fish, better, you know, landing ratio. That sold me on it, and I've been putting red treble hooks on crankbaits ever since. Tip number four, get some red treble hooks. I buy them in size 6 and size 4, and I swap them out on my crankbaits. A lot of them, the ones that my tournament partner makes, I call him the mad scientist, Mark Kiebers. He's awesome. He paints crankbaits. He did taxidermy for years. So when he paints a crankbait, they look realistic. They look like the real deal. And he keeps me supplied with those, and I put red treble hooks on them, and they catch fish. Try it yourself and see if you can prove it wrong. I think I know the results you'll have. Now, here's something you can do with a standard skirted bass jig to make it way, way more efficient. And I learned this from Shaw Grigsby years ago. There's 4 things that he does that I do to a standard skirted bass jig that has the brush guard that you put a trailer on the back and you can throw in heavy cover. I call it combat fishing, throwing in the jungle, going into the bushes and the brush and the laydowns and the treetops and the heavy weeds and any kind of nasty, gnarly cover that big bass get into, I go into with one of these skirted bass jigs with a weed guard, because it'll get through that stuff and it'll bring those fish out. The first thing we do, if you look at the weed guard on a skirted bass jig, most of them, when you buy the jig, they're too long. They extend way beyond the point of that hook. So I take scissors and I trim it parallel to the top of that hook shank, so it's only slightly above. You don't need all that extra weed guard. There's times when it will impede you from being able to hook that fish. So by trimming the weed guard so it's just above that hook point, you cut off the unnecessary stuff that can impede a good hookup, yet you still have enough brush guard there to prevent you from getting hung up, and it's easier to get that hook into the fish. Step number one. Step number two, take the skirt and hold the jig up. It'll extend way past the bend in that hook. That's too long. That's going to cover your trailer, and it's going to result in short strikes. So I bunch the skirt together, and I take scissors, and I trim it off about a quarter inch below the bend in that hook. That's holding the jig vertically, by the way. So your skirt is trimmed off till it hangs below the bend in that hook, no more than a quarter inch. Then your trailer will be very visible, and it should help prevent short strikes. Number three, I opened a gap on that hook. Almost always, it's a 180-degree bend, and the hook point is parallel to the hook shaft where it comes out of the head of that jig. If you open that hook about 3 degrees, just ever so slightly, so it's not parallel but pointed just slightly up, it's going to give you a wider gap and a bigger bite, and it's going to facilitate easier hook penetration, but you've still got almost all that 180-degree bend so that the fish is not going to easily throw the hook when he jumps and shakes his head. It's going to give you better hookups. And the fourth thing I do to ensure you have those good hookups is I sharpen that hook point right out of the package. I always make it sharper. So that's a standard skirted bass jig. There's 4 easy tweaks anybody can do to those to make them even more efficient and better at catching fish. And if you use a trailer on one, which I always do, and you got off-color water, you know where I'm going, put a rattle in that trailer. It'll get you more strikes. Now, here's a tip, and I thought he was crazy at first, but my tournament partner and my mad scientist buddy, I love him, when he was introduced to the Ned Rig, the standard TRD grub, it's just a straight piece of plastic. Most people listening are familiar with the Ned Rig, the TRD grubs from Z-Man. Such a simple bait, yet so incredibly effective, and they catch a ton of fish. That's a bait I never thought I needed to tweak. But Mark is worse than me. He can't leave anything alone. I came up with a tweak for that. And I said, well, the Ned rig doesn't need anything. It catches a ton of fish. He said, I think this is going to make a difference. You know, so he took the smallest willow leaf blade you can find, the smallest size you can get, and he slipped a tiny split ring on it. And then he took a very fine piece of wire and slipped it through that and made a twist in it. And then he took the two ends that he had and he put a little hook in them and he inserted it into the back of that Z-Man plastic, which is tough to do. But with that little return hook on it, it won't pull out. And what he created was a Ned rig that's got a little willow leaf blade that twirls on the back as the bait free falls. Something I thought, you don't need to do that. The bait is already perfect. Yet the first tournament, he showed that to me. It was a river tournament fishing for smallmouth. And we got to our first spot. He said, I'm going to try this first. No lie. His first five casts, he had a limit. I didn't even have time to make a cast. I was netting fish, trying to weigh him, you know, trying to weigh the fish and mark it and get it to the live well before I'm even getting a weight on a fish. He goes, there's another one that I ended up just dumping fish in the live well, netting them, dumping them in the live well. There's another one. He had a limit in five casts. No lie. All I did was net fish and get him in the live well. Once that, I said, can you please stop casting so I can get a weight on these fish and know what we need to cull? And he's just like, but I want to fish. I want to fish. I want to throw again. You know, it was magic. And now I got him in my boat. So there's a tweak you can do to a bait that seemingly is so good, it doesn't need a tweak. But I'll tell you what, it made a difference. And we're still using that today. Here's an interesting tip. These are a little bit more expensive, but for years and years and years, I used lead bullet weights for my Texas rig fishing. And a Texas rig for me, that's my bread and butter technique. It always puts them in the boat. For me, it never fails to work. It's a standard go-to for me when I've got fish located, especially in grass beds and on flats. But I switched to tungsten bullet weights simply because for the, you know, ounce for ounce, quarter ounce for quarter ounce, whatever weight you use, the tungsten weights are smaller because it's a denser, heavier material than lead. It's harder too. Because it's harder, it transmits information to you better than lead. Lead is soft, so it kind of deadens what you're feeling down there. With the tungsten, you can actually tell if you're in sand or gravel. You can feel the grass. You can feel logs. You can feel everything and interpret it a whole lot better with tungsten. But also, because they're smaller by weight than the lead sinkers, a problem with lead sinkers is when you have to use a heavier weight, like pitching in dense cover with a pegged weight or anything like that, that larger weight, there's times when you set the hook and you pull that out of the fish's mouth and try to get that hook set, that larger lead weight just pries their mouth open enough where that hook can slip out and never find a purchase. Because the tungsten baits are smaller, you know, by weight than the lead sinkers, they don't have a tendency to do that because they're so much smaller. For lack of a better word, it's a much more efficient weight to use. They will result in more hookups and you will feel what's going on with the bottom substrate much, much better. It's unbelievable the difference. They're a much better way. I know they're more expensive. Look for deals. That's what I do. It makes a huge difference. I don't use lead anymore. I use all tungsten bullet weights. I have a huge assortment of them in my boat, all marked by weight. Tungsten weights are always painted. You don't find them painted ones. And it's a powder coat, so it's a very slick, slippery finish, slipperier than the lead. So it also slides out much easier and lets that hook find a purchase. Now, here's something that a lot of guys are aware of. I don't know how many guys do it, but there's you can use dye for your soft plastics to change the color of them. And I do that. I don't change the entire soft plastic. Most of the time, I'm using it to color the tips of the claws on a craw trailer. I use a lot of crawfish style trailers on my heavy skirted bass jigs. But a lot of the times, I'll take a crawdad color, like just a green pumpkin or a pumpkin seed or brown, and I use the markers, the dye markers, because they're scented. And if you're using the bottle of dye and you're dipping your plastic in it, there's sooner or later you're going to drip it all over your boat carpet. It does not come out. It's a dye. It changes the color. You're going to have spotted carpet. I don't care to do that. So I use the marking pens. They're fantastic. And I take the tips of the claws and I'll color them either orange or chartreuse. And there's a lot of days when that makes a difference. When you're fishing a bass tournament and you got bass in your live well, take a point in the day to open that live well and see what they've spit up. It'll show you what you should be throwing. And most of the stuff, they'll cough up bait fish, they'll cough up perch, they'll cough up little bluegills. It gives you information what they've been feeding on and what you might better be throwing to catch a few more of those fish to get in your live well. But day in and day out, 80% of the stuff, I'd say 85% of the stuff that shows up in my live wells is crayfish. But there's certain points in the year during the season when they have specific color phases, more orange, you'll see chartreuse, you'll see real dark brown. And I use the dye markers to mimic that. So I'm matching the hatch like the trout guys do with their flies, something you can also relate to.
Yep.
But I carry those marking pens in my bass boat and I have them on hand all the time. It only takes a second to do that. If you'd use the dipping dye and with the bottles of dye, you got to let it hang and dry. With the markers, I can mark it. It doesn't drip. I give it about 15 seconds and it's ready to go. And it lasts and lasts and lasts. And like I said, the marking pens are scented. So it adds a scent to your bait as well, which doesn't hurt a thing. Now here's another thing. I got two tips left and I carry Sharpies in my boat in green, orange, black, yellow, and red. And I can use these to take any crankbait or other hard plastic baits and some soft plastic baits. And I use those permanent markers to add more detail on days when the fish are being very specific as to what they're keyed into, like particular bait fish. If I've got a crankbait, if they're spitting up bluegill in my live well, and I've got crankbaits that are close to that, I can take those marking pens and make them even closer. And now I got a bait nobody else has got that better matches the hatch to what their fish are feeding on that particular day. And in my jig seminars with Marabou jigs, guys who have seen me at the Bass Pro Shops or at sportsman shows with the Marabou jig seminar I do, I show how they can take a simple chartreuse jig and with three Sharpies, a green Sharpie, they can color the back, a little orange Sharpie, they can put a little orange on the chin of that ball head jig and on the belly of the bait. And with a black marker, they can make like five stripes on each side. And you just took a straight chartreuse jig and made it look like a perch fry. Now, nobody makes a Marabou jig in a perch pattern because it's too labor intensive and it's not cost effective to make. They would have to charge too much. The whole appeal in Marabou jigs is it's one of the cheapest lures out there. But you don't have to settle for a status quo. With three Sharpies, you can take that solid chartreuse bait. And then incidentally, everybody says, well, chartreuse is a gaudy color. That's not really natural. Yes, it is. If you think about it, crappie, they have chartreuse in them. Bluegill do. Perch, their whole belly is chartreuse. Okay, so that is a color that is in nature, but there's no bait fish out there swimming that are solid chartreuse. So when you throw a solid chartreuse marabou jig, you're showing them a color that's natural, but you're showing them a bait that's unnatural because nothing out there is solid chartreuse. But if you take those three Sharpie pens, you can make it look like a perch fry, and nobody makes that. Now you have a bait you just created with 10 seconds of your time with three Sharpie pens that everybody's got, and you made a bait that nobody sells, that nobody has, and you're perfectly matching the hatch. Here in the Northeast, fish probably eat more perch than any other bait, you know, any other game fish fry that's out there because it's so prominent. And walleye eat them, largemouth, smallmouth, everything eats them. So carry Sharpies in your boat, change the appearance of your baits, make them more realistic, catch more fish. And my final tip, I've been doing this for years. After I'd been doing it about 10 years, one particular bait company started to do it, but then they got away from it, and now nobody does it. If you throw crankbaits, guys out there that throw crankbaits, I know I've got, good grief, thousands of crankbaits, no exaggeration, I do have thousands. And it's hard to remember which ones dive 2 to 4 feet, which ones dive 4 to 6, which ones dive 6 to 8, 10 foot, 12 foot, the deep divers, 15, 20 feet. You can get a rough idea by the design and length of the diving bill that's on the front of the bait, but it's just a guess. So what I've done for 40 years now is I take a little electric engraver and I engrave on that diving lip the number, like 14 foot or 2-4 or 8-10. I engrave on that diving lip the depth that that crankbait is designed to dive to. And most of those recommendations, that bait is calculated for like 10-pound test, which is what I do on my crankbait rod, 10-pound fluorocarbon. And 12-pound fluorocarbon, 10-pound mono if I'm using mono. But I use fluorocarbon for crankbaits now, and that sinks. So I graduated to 12-pound. They can't see it anyway. But I engrave on the diving lip of my crankbaits the depth that they are designed to dive to. That takes all the guesswork out of it. And at a glance, if you got fish, you're marking fish in 14 foot. I know that's roughly this size of bill. I go to my crankbait boxes. I have them divided. They all have clear lids, and I have sections marked with a Sharpie what depth they are. I confirm that with what I have engraved on the lip, the diving bill of the crankbait, and I'm good to go. Takes all the guesswork out of it. You know how deep that bait's going to dive, and there it is. I've been doing that for 40 years. And like I said, after I'd been doing about 10 years, there was one company, I don't remember the company, but they used to stamp it right on the diving bill. But nobody does that anymore. And I don't understand why not. If you write on it with a Sharpie, it will eventually wear off. If you're using that crankbait correctly and digging bottom with it, it's going to grind it right off. With the electric engraver, it just stamps a number in there, carves it in there, doesn't change the appearance at all. If you go writing on it, it does. It puts something up front that they'll see. Those are my 10 quick tips to change things on the water for you out there and put more fish in your boat.
And put some messages in Roy's DMs
on my Instagram,
on the IG at all lowercase Roy Bilby, and he'll be happy to give you more tips.
I love it. I've been doing it since I was 5. That's my earliest childhood memory, is passing out fishing advice. Good grief. 60 years later, nothing's changed.
At least it wasn't.
I love it.
But at least it wasn't you having a bocce ball dropped on your foot.
At least it wasn't that. Take these tips, go out and use them. and get in touch with your angler within. How's that?
Perfect.